Hi, welcome to the Gooder Podcast. I'm your host, Diana Frike. As partner and CMO of Retail Voodoo, an award-winning branding agency, I have met with and worked with some of the most amazing women in the naturals industry, food, beverage, wellness, fitness. As such, I decided to create the Gooder Podcast to interview these great people and subject matter experts and have them share their insights and expertise to help businesses all around the world become gooder. I'm very excited to introduce today's guest, Miss Janet Lee. Janet Lee is an experienced marketer, innovator, and brand catalyst who has worked at both big corporations as well as startups in the CPG industry. She has a 13-year marketing career working for brands such as Sahale Snacks, Gatorade, and Starbucks. Janet was head of marketing at Sahale Snacks through its acquisition by the J.M. Smucker Company and led its evolution from a specialty brand to a national grocery brand. Most recently, Janet has worked as marketing director at PepsiCo Europe, incubating small brands such as Off the Eaten Path and Kavita, and as the head of marketing for Future Brands Business Unit. She is really passionate in helping small brands scale while protecting what makes them special. Love that. And we'll be discussing a little bit more about what she has learned at PepsiCo and Sahale and Smucker's about what big CPGs can learn from entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial brands about innovation and the innovation process. So welcome, Janet, and welcome home. You're back in Seattle.
Yes. Thank you so much, Diana. Happy to be here. Yeah. It's a beautiful summer in Seattle. Happy to be in Seattle as well.
And we're ramping up for a really good weekend too.
Yes. Some hot weather. Really hot.
Yes. Yes. What has you, you were in Europe for about 4 years. London, UK, is that right?
That's right. Central London. We lived close to Notting Hill, if you're familiar with London neighborhoods.
I am not, but I love that I am. So what has you coming back to Seattle? Are you off on a new adventure?
Yeah, I mean, we were in, my husband and I and our two kids, we were in London on an expat assignment. It was meant to be 2 years. So after 4 years, we kind of figured we actually had done a lot of what we had gone there to do, done tons of travel, had a great career experience. And so my husband's career actually brought us back to Seattle. Wow. And that's why we decided to return. We did make that decision before the pandemic, but decided to stick with it. Even despite that, because of course, as many of us are feeling, wanting to be closer to family and friends and familiar environments, I think a lot of us are feeling that right now. So,
because this is kind of a strange year, I wonder if the move home, what was that like? Was it a little bit more convoluted than normal, or was it pretty smooth and seamless?
You know, I think even in good times, an international move is hard. You add COVID in there, and there were certainly some unexpected challenges. I mean, one of which is that our flight was canceled the week before we were supposed to come home, because Europe, as you probably know, Europe banned all American travelers at that time. And so the airline just decided it wasn't worth it to have that flight anymore. So things like that, you know, that wouldn't have happened in a normal year. We've had to work through that, but you know, in the end of the day, that we're happy to be home and we're happy to be in our house. Yes. And settling in.
Oh, good. Well, welcome back. I love that we get to chat, because although you and I didn't work directly together, my business partner, David, and our team worked with your team kind of during the Sahale transition, right? As we identified earlier. And that's really how we know each other. And then I thought it was really interesting to possibly talk about that transitional time. This is back in 2013, 2014, right? About?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. And this was before Smucker's acquired them. The naturals industry was just really starting to change. It still wasn't the behemoth as it is now. And I guess the question around that, because for me, the interesting thing is like, okay, you've got this entrepreneurial type of brand, Eric and the other guys on the team whose name escaped me right now, really just Spitfires, lots of energy. It definitely was an entrepreneurial brand. Tell us, what were some of the major things the team did during this time to evolve the brand and help it break beyond natural specialty? I know the brand was the catalyst for that, but there were other things going on as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, that in Sahali for me, and if you speak to any of the people that were on the team at that time, I mean, that was such a special time for the brand. I think it was a brand that, as you say, had been around for several years already, you know, founder-led, and the two founders, Josh and Edmund, had led that business, carried it on their back for several years. And by the time I joined, I think they were really ready for that step change. They were ready to break beyond kind of a Whole Foods brand into more of the mainstream, you know, mainstream target, mainstream audience. So I think a lot of what we did was, you know, two things, I feel like major things that we did while we were there during those few years before the acquisition. One was almost just, for lack of a better way of saying it, we captured the brand's DNA. We codified what it was that made that brand special. Because as you can imagine, I mean, in the naturals industry, brands, you know, succeed for so many years by the sheer passion and the intuition of the founders. But sometimes what that brand stands for is locked in the founders' heads, and they never actually write that down. Right. So very simply, part of our job was, let's get it out of their heads. Let's get it into a form that people can see, that can inspire others. So especially as we're growing the brand team, we're bringing in agencies such as Retail Voodoo, that those other teams can also understand what this brand stands for. So I think that was one thing that we did that was really special. And I think the other was, we thought really strategically about innovation, because in order for us to really break through, for Sahali to really break through, we knew there were things that we needed to overcome. Because, you know, at the time, as you know, that brand is a trail mix brand, very expensive, very complex, foodie kind of flavor profiles. And in some ways, out of reach, right, for a lot of consumers, not very approachable to some consumers. So we thought really strategic about, how do we overcome those barriers? And so I think, you know, we introduced innovation during those few years. We called them trail mixes, but we, you know, traditionally the blends had been glazed. We took the glaze off. That removed a sugar barrier for a lot of consumers. We created much simpler flavor profiles, and, you know, created names that were very approachable, you know, Berry Macaroon, Mango Tango. I mean, names that would be more kind of palatable to the average category shopper. And therefore bring a lot more people into the brand, because they felt like it was something that they could understand.
Yeah. Well, what I remember about this process, this specifically around the naming was, and you probably remember this, the process that we do involves us actually interviewing category leaders and retailers and distributors. And it was a conversation that we had with Costco that really uncovered the whole naming thing. It was like, Sahali's a challenging name. What the heck is
right.
Cinnamon? You're making this really hard for the average consumer. And we were like, oh, let's bring this back to Sahali. Let's make sure that they have this visibility on it. So that's
right.
It's so funny. Yeah. And you know, Josh and Edmund are like every entrepreneurial brand that we've ever worked with, in that they're so dynamic and they're so passionate, they're so likable, and they know the brand is their DNA. They're almost inseparable. And there comes a time in a brand's life when you have to be able to, like, the brand needs to live on its own. There's only one of you, and you need to be able to market it. And so it's really great, this whole codification that you're talking about, and the approachability of it. There's, you know, you've got a pricing barrier as well as the flavor profile barrier, but you guys did such a great job of removing all the barriers and just having the one, and price is easier to overcome when people can buy into the brand. So I love that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, the amazing work, you know, that we did together with you guys around modernizing the brand, you know, the packaging design and how the brand looks at shelf, because I think that was another big change that helped a lot. Because I think even how we showed the product on the pack, you know, things like that, where the old product was kind of in a bowl and people didn't understand, is this like a frozen meal? You know, people would often comment, is this a frozen meal or is this, I don't understand how this is trail mix. You know, actually showing the nuts, showing the fruit, that made a huge difference.
Well, the trail mix with a glass of wine and fire in the back, like lots of complicated messaging going on the front of town.
Yeah, exactly.
But it became really, really simple to know what to do with the packaging once our teams were in alignment with the positioning and what needed, and who the real consumer was, right? And I think that's where entrepreneurial brands sometimes crash course, because they don't have the resources or they're relying on the founder owner's vision. And so things get complicated. And so it really takes a team of folks like yourself that can help them gently understand what, you know, what's important for the brand to grow and what we can keep as part of that DNA and what needs to be shed. And it's a little bit of a psychological counseling type of role that you could find yourself in. Do you feel like that's true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly it's always hard when founders have to make that leap. You know, I think the first leap was just bringing in the team, you know, bringing in the new CEO, you know, the new leadership team. And in that way, having to release a little bit of that control. Yeah. But I think, you know, I think part of what we did though, the process that we went through was very grounded though in consumer research, actually. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, we did a huge segmentation study. So I think there was comfort in knowing, hey, we really understand the landscape here and we can really pick and choose where we are going to play. In an informed way. I think that gave them some comfort to say, yeah, that makes sense.
Agreed.
You know?
Well, so now we've, like, this is the psychology. Here's Janet and the team, because I think there were a couple of other folks you were working with.
Yeah.
And this opportunity for Smuckers comes along and the acquisition happens. And, you know, these sorts mm-hmm. of transitions are simultaneously exciting and chaotic, because you've got the biggest actually the cultural matchup. And the second challenge is, of course, everybody worried about what's going to happen to me. Am I going to lose my job? Am I going to be still doing the same thing? Are you going to move me to the Midwest? All of those things kind of challenges. Can you share a little bit about what your role was during this transition and how it felt to you? You know, as much as you're comfortable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of what you're saying is exactly how it felt. I think there's a lot of apprehension, as you say, exactly. You know, you don't know what's going to happen, what types of decisions the parent company is going to make, and what level of autonomy you're going to still have after the acquisition. Yeah. But at, you know, same time, exactly what you said, you know, also a lot of excitement, because, you know, first of all, it's a recognition that this large company, much larger CPG company, has seen value in us and in the work that we've been doing. So there's validation in that. And I think there's excitement around, hey, now we have access to a lot of resources that we didn't have before. You know, whether that's experts in different areas of kind of marketing, the marketing discipline, you know, access to an agency roster that possibly we didn't have before. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, you're also excited about. I think our role as a marketing team going into this was to, number one, just share the great work that we had just done those few years leading up to the acquisition, and really evangelizing the brand, for lack of a better way of saying that. If you think about Smuckers, you know, they're a very large CPG, and most of the brands that are going to drive their business will be center store brands. You know, they obviously Smuckers jellies and jams, but also Jif peanut butter, Folgers coffee. These are brands that are really different. You know, we talk about brand DNA, very different DNA than a Sahali Snacks. So part of our job was, how do we communicate what this brand stands for? What are the guardrails? What do we want this brand to be and what do we not want it to be? So as you unleash this larger organization to go sell and gain distribution and really scale and help us scale, that they understand what's the right way to do this in a way that protects, you know, everything that we've been building kind of those previous few years.
I love that. So you're internally, you guys become, I love the word evangelist. Like, you guys are the cheerleaders, because we know that it's really easy for an organization like Smuckers to go, you guys are really cute, now we're going to do our
thing. Yeah.
And I'm simplifying it, and I know, and it's different now. At the time that this was happening, I think Justin's had just gone to Hormel, Annie's had just gone to, General Mills, or?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And the whole naturals industry was really panicking, like, what on earth is happening? You guys are going to throw Tony the Tiger on everything and destroy all this work that we've been working on. And so I can imagine that the evangelization, well, first of all, it worked, because Sahali is still that brand that your team brought over. In fact, they're innovating and creating new products that are in the same vein. The identity still remains the same. The tone and voice is still the same. Like, you guys did, I mean, yes, we did great work together, but yeah. I know that the harder work was once you guys were within the organization and protecting that. So good job on that. And so I love it, that I love the term evangelist, and I hope that it's adopted by a lot of people, because acquisitions are happening all the time.
Yes, certainly far more often now, right? And far earlier in a brand's life as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of really brands that have not quite matured that are being, they're being picked up because of potential. You know, it's all investment. But when you think back at it, when you think back at that time, what sort of things happened during the transition that you would not have predicted going into it that you would like to have better been prepared for, like that something that tools that maybe you picked up then after going through the process that you now take with you when you're working on types of transitions?
You know, one of the things that I think I didn't anticipate was, it comes down to how to motivate the sales team. Because one of the biggest opportunities for us with the acquisition was having access to this amazing national sales team that had relationships with the key retailers across the entire country. And I think one thing that we didn't anticipate was gonna be how hard it was to get their focus and their prioritization around Sahali Snacks.
Uh-huh.
Now, as a part of the acquisition, you know, it was a very intentional decision by Smuckers to put us within their, they call it the consumer foods division, but we're with the big boys. I mean, they didn't put us in the naturals division. They put us in the consumer foods division, which is we're with the big boys, the big, really, you know, really large scale brands.
Yeah.
And the sales team, all sales teams have incentives set up in certain ways to incentivize certain types of behavior. It's going to be driving behavior that's obviously going to grow the business, and it's going to grow it primarily on the backs of the scale brand.
Sure.
And I think, you know, for us at that time, at least, it was a volume target. So it was literally pounds out the door.
Yes.
So when you think about Sahali, right? We are a light, a very light, literally in terms of ounce weight, product, highly profitable, but very light. So in that way, we didn't align with the sales team's motivation.
Yes.
And so that's something that I learned, which is, you know, we had to tell a different story. We had to show the value to the portfolio in a different way. And that was ended up being profit, driving profit.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we had to change minds. We had to change how people viewed their job and how to prioritize what they had in their basket when they went to retailers. But that's something I'm not sure I definitely didn't anticipate, I think, going into that acquisition.
That's so interesting, because of course, during our process, we're always taking the sales team into consideration and how they're seeing the marketplace. But this incentivization, when you're in a multinational or you've got a sales team that are carrying multiple brands, they're going to want to move forward with that, with whatever provides them the highest possibility of sales. So I can imagine.
Yeah.
So you're not only an evangelist, but you're also an educator.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a coach,
Right, exactly. And I think, I mean, a lot of small naturals brands, I know they probably go through a similar struggle with brokers or, you know, when you work with any selling organization, right, that's carrying a lot of different brands, you always have to fight for your brand to be at the top of that list. But I think it's just more when you go from Sahali, where we had a dedicated sales team that was 100% all in, understood the brand, knew how to sell it, And then you move into a large organization where actually you're number 10 on the list of things that we need to talk to our retailers about. You know, it just, it's just very challenging.
Interesting. Okay. Well, of course, since then, this big CPG brand, big CPGs, multinationals, brand families, however we want to call them or slice and dice them, their interest in naturals and better for you spaces have certainly accelerated, not only investing in incubators and acquiring brands, but developing their own projects and initiatives. And this is sort of where you found yourself at PepsiCo, right?
That's right. Yeah. So in 2016, I left Smucker's at the time. We moved to London and I joined PepsiCo Europe. So for the past 4 years, I've basically worked in the space you're describing, which is how do big companies capture a little bit of the magic of small, high growth, better for you brands? And, you know, so I led for a few years, I led an incubator team within the snacks category. And then for the most recent period, I was head of marketing for a business unit they call Future Brands, which is all of their, I mean, basically all the brands that are too small for them to really know what to do with. So these are, you know, less than 5 million. I mean, they're going to be very small brands.
Yes.
That they kind of say, we don't know how to manage these types of brands. And so it was a business unit that was set up specially to incubate those types of brands and protect them and grow them in the right way.
Protect and grow. That's so awesome. And the reason why I say this is awesome, because, you know, PepsiCo and the naturals industry have a weird relationship. And it's not just PepsiCo, it's all of these multinationals, right? The naturals industry has fought against the kind of the democratization. I'm using this word incorrectly, but here, it's not the democratization that they're against. What they're afraid is that, and they have been afraid of the naturals brands, is that these big brands like the General Mills, like the Unilevers, like, you know, are going to come in, going to take these darling brands, and they're going to want to make the profit. They want to increase the profitability, and they're going to take away all of the hard work in regards to ingredients and innovation. Like, and yet here we are now in 2020, and we have, the universe has changed completely in every way, shape, or form. We've got not just COVID, but I'm talking about now we have brands like PepsiCo who are investing in these initiatives and passionate about them, that it's more than just another line item or another brand to stick in the brand family. Like there's definitely an initiative there, and it's so exciting for me. And I feel like the bridge is getting closer and closer. Are we still going to have the hardcore vegans and the organic, you know, people from the 60s and 70s mindset that are still going to be against it? But what I love is you guys having these big brands having the resources to be able to start changing the American diet in baby steps. We're never going to get somebody to go from a Mountain Dew to alkaline water without it, you know, like there's got to be baby steps between that. And so I love these initiatives, and I love to hear that, you know, the brands that you were working with, like Off the Eaten Path and Kavita, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Nutrition Greenhouse program here. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, before we head in that direction, can you talk a little bit about other learnings that you brought with you when you went to PepsiCo after this change? Is there anything else that was unique to this transition that you felt like ended up being a tool in your tool belt when you went to PepsiCo?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that I learned at Sahali that I carry with me now. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things is this kind of roll your sleeves up work ethic, because you can't help. I mean, in a startup, you know, it's you and maybe, you know, we had a team of three marketing people, you know, and you're not only setting the vision and the strategy, you're doing the work. And I think I brought that with me to PepsiCo, and I think that helped a lot, because I think when you think about big companies, all marketing teams at big companies, for the most part, will rely a lot on agencies. And I think, you know, that was something, I think going from Sahali back to a big company again, I was surprised again at how much that happens. For almost everything, you know, that you're relying on a strong agency network, but you're creating almost distance between your team and the work and the ideas. And so for me, what I tried to do in the teams that I was leading was to say, okay, we can go to agencies, but let's try to do the work ourselves. Let's try to do the thinking ourselves, because I think there's a greater sense of ownership. And I think in some ways you mentioned agility, there is more agility, because again, you feel the ownership on that idea and you are hands-on with the work in a way that you can't be when you're working with agencies.
Yeah, and I think that's true. Yeah, it's so interesting because, of course, we've worked with Walmart. Like, we've worked with those guys, and then we've worked with startups, which have, you know, they're bootstrapping it with their savings and worked with all of it in between. It's really interesting observation about that separation of the brand that I wouldn't have articulated that way, and I think that's really great. I think maybe to go one step further is maybe it's not that you don't want to work with agencies because you do want the ownership, you do want the connection with the brand, but it's about being focused and kind of saying, this is an outage for us. We need extra ammunition here, and bringing in those teams strategically rather than just because this is what you do.
Exactly. I mean, you think about, like, even, you know, the first step in that process would be to write a brief. You can write a good brief, and you know what you need, and you know what you want, and you know why you want that work to be done. Or you can write a bad brief, which I'm sure you've received many of those in your career history, where they're unclear, or you can tell it's something that someone's been told to do, but they don't really understand why. And I think exactly you're right. There's always going to be, like, great agencies and work that you need to kind of work with agencies to get done. But are you clear? Yeah, to your point, can you write a really good brief? Can you write a brief that's, able to articulate why you're doing the work, and what you're going to do with the work when it's done? Because I think that's the part. I think sometimes you just get into autopilot, right? It's very natural.
Yeah.
You know, and so for everything, you're just kind of outsourcing. Right. And I think that's the thing that we wanted to kind of start changing. And that's something that very much came from my Sahali days.
Right. Yeah, that speaks to that agileness that we're kind of working around, is like, how do we be more agile as an organization? And it's not necessarily from a cost savings perspective. I love that you're talking about, it's about ownership of the brand and the connection with the brand and having meaning with the brand, and not being that I just want to flip this, I want to raise this, I just want to grow sales by 1-2% so that I can get the next gig, right? It's about loving the brand and doing the work. So I love that. The second component the thing that I want to say, because you're right, I have seen some interestingly written briefs that cause a lot of chaos and confusion on the recipient's end. And then it kind of starts the relationship off a little bit rocky. But I will tell you, the best creative brief I have had to date was provided to me, and it would be no surprise, from when we were working with Walmart, the tightest creative briefs ever seen in my life. And I had it hanging up on my wall for a while. Printed it out, and I was like, this is a description of a really, I mean, it was better than anything I had ever written, I'd ever seen written. I was like,
wow.
So I can tell you, from an agency side, we love that, because then we know what you're here about as well. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Now, in your time working back and forth between, you know, the PepsiCos and the Starbucks and the Sahalis, you've witnessed a sort of weak spot in innovation. We've kind of already alluded to that a little bit, but particularly for these big multi-brand, multinational organizations, what are those things that you believe that big CPG struggles with to adopt, or maybe need to learn from these smaller, more entrepreneurial brands about agility, about innovation, or maybe even about business operations? I mean, they're all kind of tied together, but I hope you understand the question.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's, you know, I would even flip it and say, what do I feel entrepreneurs are really good at? Like, what part of that innovation cycle are they really good at? And I think, for me, it is the very, very front end. It is a very early part of that innovation development process. And I mean, there's a, to me, it's because if you, or you could say, you know, kind of when you think about time zero to maybe like year one or year, maybe even year two, that's the part I feel like entrepreneurs really excel at. And it's because they do a lot of things organically that big companies have a hard time replicating. So some of those things, I mean, obviously entrepreneurs can come up with great, crazy breakthrough ideas, and they're able to then go figure out, validate, is that a good idea? They're able to get traction maybe with a local retailer, and they're able to quickly get that feedback loop set up. So they are hearing from consumers, they're hearing from retailers, and you know, they're creating those kind of small iterations to the proposition. They're improving it, they're evolving it, and they're making it better. And that is something that, you know, whatever you want to call that, you know, fail fast, test and learn, seed and grow, there's a lot of different names for that. But I think entrepreneurs do that very naturally, and I think that makes them much more effective in that early stage in proving ideas out. You think about the flip side in big CPG, it's quite different, because I think, again, it comes back to incentives. And I think big CPG, big corporates are set up to mitigate risk. Right. They're set up to scale and grow their largest brands. And so the way innovation will happen, well, first of all, innovation for the most part, from my experience, will end up being line extensions, right? Because yeah, it's safe, right? It's like, why do we have, you know, five Minions movies, or I don't know how many there are, because it's a safe franchise.
Yeah.
You can build on. So that will be the playbook for most, you know, big companies, is to go off line extensions and known brands. But I think there's a lot of things about how innovation happens at big companies that doesn't enable them to behave the same way. So, you know, there's typically, again, a lot of reliance on research, which takes a long time and is a point in time kind of factoid, right?
Yeah.
Versus like, you know, in contrast to this feedback loop that we talked about with entrepreneurs, where they're, it's real time. It's every day. Yeah. It's every week. Research is, again, point in time, and it's probably several hundred consumers, but it's people you've never spoken to.
Right.
You know, and that makes a huge difference in terms of the quality of the learning. And I think the other is, just inherently in big companies, you're going to have big teams, big yeah, cross-functional teams, lots of stakeholders, probably a, most likely a gate process that takes a long time. And so because of that, you tend towards, you know, consensus decision-making and things yeah, that are less helpful, I think, in the early stages of an idea.
Lots of cooks in the kitchen. And yeah, each of those cooks has to be able to come back to their business unit manager and be able to say, right, this was my participation, this is how I added value. I mean, you've got that, I mean, you've got the human dynamics, the personal dynamics in there. You also have like major corporations going, I don't know if I want to invest $5 million in a single year against something that may not see any kind of growth for 5 to 10 years.
Right.
Versus a founder owner who's like, I made $40,000 this month. Hot damn. Like, you know?
Yeah.
So I right, think there's a little bit of an ecosystem and might need to be like, and it sounds a little bit like there are multinationals out there, the big CPG brand or brand families that are looking at that and kind of going, maybe we need to let this part of the family behave differently than this part yeah, of the family. And I know there's a little bit of cannibalization, you know, as you have these groups like PepsiCo, where on one side you're selling a Pepsi product, and the other side you're selling a Life water, and sometimes they're in conflict with each other. I know there's a little bit of that happening within the brand as well. Well, we can't really accelerate this over here because it might cannibalize these sales over here. And so I know it gets a little bit tricky, and that's like a, that's its own topic in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when, so it leads me to this question then is, do you feel that it's realistic to have these kinds of organizations, like, again, we'll go back to PepsiCo, trying to diversify their product portfolios to include these innovative and natural brands? Do you think it's realistic that they can operate and think nimbly like these smaller brands? What's it going to take?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is possible. I think, you know, the experience I've just had these past few years makes me believe it is possible. But I think, as you say, I think there's things that you need to do differently. I think you have to establish a much different team culture than there is in the mothership, to almost bring in some of those qualities that we talked about that entrepreneurs have. You need to, you know, empower, you need to enable that team to be nimble, to trust their own instincts, to not be bogged down by maybe the heavy kind of decision-making process that you would normally go through. And I think in some ways you need to retrain those individuals on that team to trust themselves and trust their own instincts. Because I think something I realized while working at Sahali was in some ways that was trained out of me, because when you work at big companies, nobody's looking to you as an assistant brand manager to make a decision or make the call. You know, you're trained to, you know, fill in the gate document that goes to a committee that makes the decision. And so in some ways it's almost like when someone turns to you and asks you, what do you think? Do you think this is a good idea? That I realized you almost have to retrain people to hear their inner voice, because you lose that along the way. But I think that's something, you know, as a part of establishing that team culture, that needs to be part of it as well. And I think the other thing is, there's an infrastructure, I'll call it an infrastructure issue, which is you have to lower the bar of what it takes to get started. Because at big companies, the bar for something to get out the door is extremely high in terms of, you know, volumes, in terms of revenue you've already talked about. You know, unless it's, let's say, you know, I'm just making up numbers, unless it's 10 million in its first year, it's not worth our time. Yeah. You've got to change that, right? Exactly like you're saying. You need to lower the bar for what is an idea that's worth us pursuing. And I think, you know, the follow-on effect from that is you need to then create the infrastructure to support that. Because it's something that I don't think that, you know, us in marketing sometimes we think about is, you know, but there's co-manufacturers in the mix. You know, do you have co-manufacturers that can operate at very, very low volumes? You know, there's food safety, there's regulatory. I mean, there's so many other considerations that you need in place to enable you to lower that bar. But that's something that absolutely needs to happen in pockets in order for big companies to have a shot at doing this early stage piece. Kind of
Sure.
more similarly to how entrepreneurs do.
Yeah. So it's so great, because I feel like entrepreneurs that are listening right now should feel emboldened, like they should have a superhero cape on, because there are things you can do better. And then there's nothing wrong with it. We need big brands, we need small brands. Like there's nothing wrong with PepsiCo going into the effort. In fact, PepsiCo and Coca-Cola are looking at incubators all over and looking at and watching these small brands and seeing what they're doing and seeing, oh my gosh, that's really awesome, and letting them do that hard work or even supporting those hard works. So there's nothing wrong with that. But is I kind of want to touch on that nutrition, the nutrition greenhouse, and that kind of bridging the gap that you were talking about, and that lowering the bar and introducing new ways of thinking. Can you just touch on what that initiative is about?
Yes, so actually, Nutrition Greenhouse is our version of a PepsiCo incubator slash accelerator for small external brands.
Gotcha.
And so it actually started in Europe, I believe in 2016, I want to say. But it started in Europe. So the first class of that program went through in Europe. And I think, you know, it's the way that the program has worked, is, you know, it's no strings attached. There's grants given by PepsiCo to these startups as a way to accelerate their businesses, and they get, you know, mentorship for several months from PepsiCo teams to help grow their businesses. And so I think, you know, I think initially it was started out as a way for us to have a role to play within the startup ecosystem, for us to observe some of these trends that are kind of very early and emerging, kind of more up close. But I think one of the unexpected benefits that I personally witnessed was how much the entrepreneurs affected PepsiCo from a cultural standpoint.
Oh, okay.
Because again, we talked about culturally how different entrepreneurs are, you know, how resilient they are, how much they persevere, how much passion they have, for their ideas. And, you know, we assign mentors for each startup that we bring through Nutrition Greenhouse. And those in Europe at least tend to be some of our more senior PepsiCo employees. So if you think about senior directors and above. And so, you know, working that closely over a series of months with entrepreneurs, they come out of it so inspired. Yeah. They come out of it so recharged and revitalized. And then that trickles down to their teams. And I think there's a cultural effect here that I don't think we maybe anticipated, but was such a refreshing thing to see happen.
Well, I hadn't thought of that either. You know, a lot of people who are in these roles are MBAs, sometimes multiple MBAs. They learn that success is a series of charts and graphs. And here they are teamed up with somebody that maybe has far less education on paper, but you know, their life experience and their experience working the brand and their learning in real time. And of course, entrepreneurs, most of the time, particularly women, start something because they have a passion about it. It's more than, can I make money? And that's probably somewhere where PepsiCo, that's just not a sweet spot. PepsiCo, how do we make money? Entrepreneur, I want to cure my child's diet. Like, there's no competition there, right? So I hadn't considered that there would be this kind of, it's almost a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Because I think, you know, the temptation with programs like that might be to say, you know, what do we get out of this? You know, what is the benefit to doing this? And I think that's something that is it's a softer benefit. To your point, it's not driving the bottom line, but I think there is real value there in culture change.
So you're back in the US, fresh from 4 years in the UK. I'm curious, what sort of trends are you hopeful to see and find? You know, I guess there's a little bit of like, what does the US look like? What did you learn about from the UK? Are there any like, I can't believe this, like, you know, any of those things? And we talked about NutriScore as well. There's probably another 30 minutes that we could talk about, but maybe what are the Yeah, Americans eat more like this, and that's surprising. What do you want to share there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the world is a lot more connected and a lot more global than it ever has been. And so there's, you know, as I was thinking about this, I mean, I think there's not any one thing that I can point to that only, you know, that only is happening in Europe, you know, because obviously these trends are all global. But one of the most compelling things that I personally experienced was more this trend in this, people taking very seriously kind of packaging waste, and the emergence of, you know, zero waste, not only stores, but zero waste aisles within large grocery retailers. And I think, you know, you think about even the largest UK retailer, Tesco, is trialing some very progressive things, like working with a company called Loop that's basically reusable, returnable packaging. You know, and so I think the degree to which you see people taking that seriously and you see real initiatives kind of landing, you know, they're mostly kind of at that market test level, but real initiatives happening and landing that you can see visible evidence of that progress. I think that's really exciting.
That's great. There was a company here that I was following, I want to say about 10 years ago, not a company, it was a retailer called Ingredients. Are you familiar with these folks?
No.
So they were on the front end of, they were a zero waste grocery store, 100% zero waste. They were on the front end. This is 10 years ago. So they ended up failing because they just couldn't optimize it, right? And there was not enough traction or adoption from consumers, but I think the idea could probably be brought in again. But again, Tesco, right? Tesco, Walmart, Kroger, Target, those retailers have the resources and the abilities to drive those types of initiatives. So that's exciting to hear.
Yeah, definitely. And I think something that, that would be great if more big retailers take that step to try something like that. And work out the kinks, as you say.
So is, maybe we already addressed this, anything surprising about the UK that you would not have expected when you went in? Food or groceries or?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about working in marketing in Europe, and it's not UK specific, it's more just how complex it is. You know, because when you have a role, you know, like I had a role that was West Europe focused, you underestimate how different consumers behave in every country. So you think about a British consumer versus a Spanish versus a French versus a Dutch consumer. They all behave in some ways, you know, very, very differently. And so when you're talking about, for me, you know, in my latest job, trying to sell different products, you know, like kombucha or gazpacho in these different countries, I think, you know, the interesting thing for me is, you know, how much you need to almost be an anthropologist and understand, okay, how do consumers eat? You know, how do they, what are the cultural norms around family and eating and social eating? And, you know, and you almost need to like start from scratch again when you're bringing new propositions into a different country. To understand those nuances, to understand how you almost need to adjust how you market and how you sell things.
Yeah, and find those common barriers, because it's not like that we're looking for the differences, we're looking for the commonality between all of them.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, it's finding, yeah, like where, how do you, yeah, simplify and standardize, and then at the same time, be sensitive to kind of the local nuance.
Yes.
It's that kind of, yeah, that balance that we're always trying to strike, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, coming up here on the end, I have just a couple of more questions for you before we wrap up. You're looking back at your history, and it could be recent, it could be farther back, but I always find that there's so much learnings in those moments of what I'll use the word failure, but where something just really didn't turn out the way you had hoped to. Do you have one of those aha moments in a failed situation? I'm using the wrong word, but you know what I'm asking, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting that, because it's almost like part of what we did in my most recent role was almost try to destigmatize the word failure, because you're right. People don't want to talk about failure, but in some ways it's necessary. Yeah. Especially when you work in innovation or you work in spaces where failure rates are really high.
Right.
It's very natural. But yeah, I think one example for me was actually we were working with Tesco on a food waste snack. So we basically, Tesco again is a champion also of eliminating or reducing food waste, because as you know, that's a huge global problem right now with how much resources are used to grow food that is never eaten.
Yes.
And so, you know, and Tesco specifically is very vocal. Their CEO is part of, I believe, a UN coalition to basically work on this problem. And so we, you know, had talked with them about possibly developing together a snack where we could use food waste from within the system. You know, and really great intentions and motivation on both sides. And I think, you know, we went into it and ultimately, I guess, it was a failure because we weren't able to launch it for all the right reasons, you know, yeah. Because I think, you know, as we dug into it, we couldn't do it in a way that I think both of us felt, you know, felt good about. And I think for me, you know, being somebody who's very driven, who's very results oriented, I think what I took away from that is sometimes the right thing to do is not to push that project through to the end. And allow it to fail in some ways, because it's the right thing to do, because it's not meeting the original objectives that we intended, and it's not addressing the problem that we both wanted to address. But I think, yeah, that's an example of, you know, being so passionate about something and really wanting something to happen, but knowing when to let go and when to say, basically, it's not going to happen.
I have a question about that. When an effort like that moves forward and you need to stop it, are those learnings socialized amongst all the other brands, or does it kind of just disappear with the project?
I mean, we, on that one in particular, we certainly tried to do that. So we tried to package up the learning, And we would, we did share that in a few different kind of key meetings.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, I think that's something that can be done more, because I agree with you that we don't often talk about failure because it's not viewed as a good thing. But there's so much to learn from that, as you say.
And I love that. You know, that's totally in line with brands like Forager's got some initiatives around that. Regrained, there are a lot of those small, nimble brands that will probably do a lot of that learning. And you guys and the PepsiCos of the world will kind of look back at that again and do a take two, because that's invariably what happens. Didn't work this time. Let's try it again.
Yeah.
So love that. Well, last thing here, are there any rituals? You know, I know you've moved, you've changed, you're changing in the middle of a job change. you are in the part of the industry where things change is just par for the course. You're working with innovative brands. You're trying to kind of grow people and brands from nowhere. What is it that, what kind of rituals do you keep for yourself to keep you positive and focused?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, the first thing for me is I've started to carve out the very early morning, like at least an hour for myself. And I think a lot of people do this, right? But just to practice some meditation, some journaling, some even just allowing me myself to sit with my thoughts and feelings and to do an assessment of how am I feeling today? You know, and what is my energy today? And, you know, are there things that I need to let my mind kind of mull over and use that quiet time? And, you know, with I have two young boys. So for me, it's like, how do I beat them to wake up earlier than them so I actually get that time? Because, you know, that sometimes can be quite early to actually beat them and, you know, getting up early enough. But, you know, that's something that I've started, you know, recently, but has been so helpful, and it's now become something that I really treasure and I really just, you know, want to protect and maintain. But that's helped a lot.
Wonderful. I have yet to master that. I find myself going straight to email within minutes of getting up. I know better, but it's a habit that I really, really want to break. Well, before we go, you have shared a lot of information here. If somebody wanted to reach out to you and just kind of ask you more or just be connected, is LinkedIn the best way for people to reach out to you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that would work.
And are you Janet Lee or?
Yeah, Janet Lee. Yeah, there's a lot of Janet Lees. You can imagine in the LinkedIn. But yeah, if Janet Lee PepsiCo, I think that will probably come up with the right one. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time today. So great. And welcome back to Seattle, and wish you luck during this transition. I hope you survive the entry of the school year, which will be its own challenge, and then your re-entry into whatever is next in your career.
Thank you so much, Diana. It's been fun.
This episode is sponsored by Retail Voodoo, a creative marketing firm specializing in growing, fixing, and reinventing brands in the food, beverage, wellness, and fitness industries. If your Naturals brand is in need of positioning, package design, or marketing activation, we're here to help. You can find more information at retail-voodoo.com. And so there you go. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this channel and share with your network. Until next time, be well and do gooder.